Israel also has a close military alliance with the other major regional military power, Turkey. The U.S.-Turkey-Israel alliance is sometimes called the Axis of Evil in the Middle East. The term is understandable. There is always plenty of evil to go around, and this axis at least has the merit of existing, unlike the one concocted by George Bush's speechwriters, which consists of two states that had been at war for 20 years, and a third that was presumably thrown in because it is non-Muslim and universally reviled. U.S. academic specialist Robert Olson reports that 12% of Israel's offensive aircraft are to be permanently stationed in Turkey and have been flying reconnaissance flights along Iran's border, signaling to Iran that it would soon be challenged elsewhere by Turkey and its Israeli and American allies. He suggests that these operations are part of a long-term effort to undermine and perhaps partition Iran, separating its northern Azeri regions, rather as Russia attempted to do in 1946, one of the early Cold War crises, thus turning the country into an anemic geopolitical entity, barred from access to the Caspian Sea and Central Asia generally. Olson also discusses one of the usual background concerns, to expedite development of oil pipelines from the Caspian region to Turkey in the Mediterranean, cutting out Iran. The U.S.-Turkey alliance might undergo some changes if the U.S. is able to shift military bases from eastern Turkey to Iraq, right in the heart of the world's richest energy reserves. U.S. anger over Turkey's democratic deviation in 2002 and 2003 could weaken U.S.-Turkey military and intergovernmental relations, but that seems doubtful. The existing tripartite alliance extends to parts of Central Asia and recently to India as well. Since its government came under the control of the Hindu right in 1998, India has shifted its international stance considerably, moving toward a closer military relationship with both the U.S. and its Israeli client. Indian political analyst Praful Bidwai writes that the ruling Hindu nationalist fascination with Zionism is rooted in Islamophobia and anti-Arabism and hyper-nationalism. Its ideology is Sharon's machismo and ferocious jingoism. It sees Hindus and Jews, plus Christians, as forming a strategic alliance against Islam and Confucianism. Addressing the American Jewish Committee in Washington, India's National Security Advisor, Brajesh Mishra, called for development of a U.S.-Israel-India triad that will have the political will and moral authority to take bold decisions in combating terror. According to Bidwai, the growing Indo-Israel political-military contacts are supplemented by coordination of the influential Hindu nationalist and Israeli lobbies in the U.S. India and Israel are both significant military powers, with nuclear weapons and delivery systems, and the emerging alliance system is another factor contributing to WMD proliferation, terror, and disorder in the unstable belt and beyond. U.S.-Israel relations, origins, and maturation. It does not take much insight into world affairs to predict that the cauldron of animosities in the Middle East will continue to boil. Internal conflicts have been exacerbated as the industrial world shifted toward an oil-based economy from World War I, and the incomparable petroleum resources of the Middle East were discovered. After World War II, a high priority of U.S. policy was to ensure its control over a region of such great material wealth and strategic significance. In its day in the sun, Britain had controlled the region by delegating authority to clients, with British force in the background. In the terminology of the Foreign Office, local management was to be left to an Arab facade of weak, compliant rulers, while Britain's absorption of these virtual colonies would be veiled by constitutional fictions, a device considered more cost-effective than direct rule. With variations, the device is familiar elsewhere. The population did not passively submit. Fortunately for imperial planners, air power was becoming available to control civilian populations, though some, like Winston Churchill, were enamored of the possibilities of using poison gas to subdue recalcitrant Arabs, mainly Kurds and Afghans. In the interwar years, there were attempts to ban or limit war, but Britain made sure these would not interfere with imperial rule, setting a precedent for its successor in world control. Specifically, Britain undermined attempts to restrict the use of air power against civilians. The reasons were expressed succinctly by the distinguished statesman Lloyd George, who praised the British government for reserving the right to bomb niggers. Fundamental moral principles tend to have a long life. This one is no exception. The U.S. took over the British framework, but added another layer of control, peripheral states, preferably non-Arab, that could serve as local cops on the beat, in the terminology of the Nixon administration. Police headquarters would of course remain in Washington, with a branch office in London. Turkey was a leading member of the club from the outset, joined by Iran in 1953, when a US-UK military coup restored the Shah, overthrowing a conservative parliamentary government that was seeking to control its own resources. The US has been concerned more with control than access. After World War II, North America was the world's major oil producer, though this position was not expected to last long. Later, a major exporter to the US was Venezuela. Current projections of US intelligence are that the US will continue to rely primarily on Atlantic Basin resources, those in the Western Hemisphere and West Africa, which are more stable and reliable than those of the Middle East. But as throughout the post-war period, that does not remove the perceived need to retain control. Control over the great material prize of the Gulf ensures that US-UK energy corporations will be the main beneficiaries of enormous profits. The wealth recycles to the US and British economies in many other ways as well, including military hardware, hence high-tech industry generally, construction projects, and treasury securities. The recognized stupendous strategic power of the region translates into a lever of world domination. All of this was understood clearly by those who planned the post-war world and retains its force. U.S. intelligence expects Gulf energy resources to become even more significant in the years ahead, hence also the drive to maintain control, whether the U.S. itself relies heavily on these resources or not. The global system of military bases from the Pacific to the Azores was designed in considerable measure for operations in the Gulf region. U.S. counterinsurgency and subversion in Greece and Italy in the 1940s were in part motivated by concern over the free flow of Middle East oil to the West. By now, the basing system extends to the former Soviet satellites, Bulgaria and Romania. Since the Carter years, the major U.S. intervention forces have been aimed at the Gulf. Until recently, the only fully reliable military base nearby was the British-held island of Diego Garcia, from which the inhabitants were expelled. The U.S. still refuses them the right of return, overruling decisions of the British courts. The issue is unknown in the U.S., much like the case of Okinawa. The Afghan War left the U.S. with military bases in Afghanistan and Central Asia, helping to position U.S. corporations more favorably in the current phase of the great game to control Central Asian resources, and also to extend the encirclement of the far more important Persian Gulf. It had long been anticipated that one of Washington's goals in Iraq was to obtain military bases right in the heart of the oil-producing regions, as reported at the war's end. Other likely goals also moved into the public domain at the war's end. The two things that were never openly discussed, that never became part of the national conversation, were oil and money, Bob Herbert commented. Those crucial topics were left to the major behind-the-scenes operators, many of whom are now cashing in. U.S. relations with Israel largely developed within this general context. In 1948, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were impressed with Israel's military prowess, describing Israel as second only to Turkey in military power in the region. They suggested that Israel might offer the U.S. means to gain strategic advantage in the Middle East, to offset Britain's declining role. 10 years later, these considerations gained some concrete significance. The year 1958 was highly significant in world affairs. The Eisenhower administration identified three major crises: Indonesia, North Africa, and the Middle East. All involved oil producers and Islamic political forces, which were then secular. Eisenhower and Secretary of State Dulles stressed that there was no Russian involvement in any of these crises. The problem was the familiar devil, radical nationalism. In North Africa, the concern was the Algerian struggle for independence, which the U.S. wanted quickly settled. In Indonesia, the culprit was Sukarno, who was one of the leaders of the despised non-aligned movement, and was also allowing too much democracy. A popular-based party of poor peasants was gaining influence. In the Middle East, the villain was Nasser, described as a new Hitler by panicked U.S. and British leaders. He too was a pillar of the non-aligned movement, and his influence, it was feared, might tempt others to pursue an independent course. Those fears appeared to be realized in 1958 when a coup in Iraq, assumed to be Nasserite in origin, overthrew the British-backed government. Consequences reverberate to the present. The Iraqi coup led to intense U.S.-UK discussions. Policymakers were concerned that Kuwait might seek independence and that even Saudi Arabia might succumb to the disease. The British economy was heavily reliant on profits from Kuwaiti oil production and investment. Britain decided to grant Kuwait nominal independence, though we must also accept the need, if things go wrong, ruthlessly to intervene. Whoever it is has caused the trouble, Foreign Secretary Selwyn Lloyd explained. The U.S. adopted the same stand on forceful intervention with regard to the bigger prizes, Saudi Arabia, and the other Gulf Emirates. Eisenhower sent military forces to Lebanon to block a perceived nationalist threat there and to ensure control over pipelines. He reiterated his concern over the most strategically important area of the world and emphasized that loss of control would be far worse than the loss of China, regarded as the worst post-war catastrophe because of the strategic position and resources of the Middle East. Another country of critical importance that might, it was feared, fall under Nasserite influence was Jordan, then the regional base for British military power. Israel assisted in assuring British control. Washington planners recognized that Israel was the only regional power that had taken risks for the sake of relieving the situation in the area. A memorandum for the National Security Council advised that if we choose to combat radical Arab nationalism and to hold Persian Gulf oil by force if necessary, a logical corollary would be to support Israel as the only strong pro-West power left in the Near East, along with the peripheral powers, Turkey and Iran. At the same time, in 1958, Israel-Turkey relations were established with a visit to Turkey by Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. By 2000, Ephraim Inbar writes, Israel's relations to Turkey were second only to the closeness of Israel-U.S. ties. In 1967, the U.S.-Israeli alliance was firmly in place. Israel destroyed Nasser, thus protecting the facade in the Arabian Peninsula and also striking a powerful blow against the non-aligned movement. That was considered a major contribution to U.S. power. There was also a significant effect within the U.S. ideological domain, an important topic that I will have to put aside. Recall the three major crises of 1958. The threat of independent Arab nationalism in the Middle East was overcome by the 1967 war. The North African crisis ended with Algerian independence. The crisis in Indonesia was resolved by a huge massacre, mainly of landless peasants, which the CIA described as one of the great mass murders of the 20th century, comparable to those of Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. This staggering mass slaughter, as the New York Times called it, was greeted with unrestrained euphoria in the West. It eliminated the mass-based political party of the poor and opened the doors wide to Western investors. As in the Middle East, another pillar of the non-aligned movement was demolished. Somewhat similar processes were underway in Latin America and, to a more limited extent, in India, the last major stronghold of non-alignment. Throughout, the U.S. role was significant, sometimes crucially so. The U.S. is a global power, like England before it. It is often misleading to focus on one region of the world, forgetting that global planning is in Washington. Keeping nevertheless to the Middle East, in 1970, Israel performed another service by deterring possible Syrian intervention to protect Palestinians who were being massacred in Jordan. U.S. aid to Israel quadrupled. U.S. intelligence, along with such influential figures concerned with the Middle East as Senator Henry Jackson, described the tacit alliance of Israel, Iran, Saudi Arabia as a solid basis for U.S. power in the region, with Turkey taken for granted. In 1979, the Shah fell, and the Israel-Turkey alliance became even more important as a regional base. The alliance welcomed a new member, replacing the Shah, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which the Reagan administration removed from the official list of terrorist states in 1982 so that the U.S. could freely provide the tyrant with aid. Israel's choices over the past 30 years have reduced its options considerably. On its present course, it has virtually no alternative to serving as a U.S. base in the region and complying with U.S. demands. The options were starkly illuminated in 1971 when President Anwar Sadat of Egypt offered Israel a full peace treaty in return for Israeli withdrawal from Egyptian territory. Sadat offered nothing to the Palestinians and omitted reference to the occupied territories. In his memoirs, Yitzhak Rabin, then ambassador to the U.S., refers to the famous offer as a milestone on the path to peace, though it contained bad news as well, the condition that Israel withdraw from Egyptian territory, in accord with official U.S. policy and the basic diplomatic document, Security Council Resolution 242 of November 1967. Israel had a fateful choice. It could accept peace and integration into the region, or insist on confrontation, hence inevitable dependency on the U.S. It chose the latter course, not on grounds of security, but because of a commitment to expansion. That is clear in Israeli sources. General Haim Bar-Lev, a leading figure in the governing Labor Party, expressed the common understanding when he wrote in a Labor Party journal that we can have peace, but I think if we continue to hold out, we can obtain more. The more that was of primary interest at the time was the northeastern Sinai, from which the inhabitants were brutally expelled into the desert to make way for the establishment of the all-Jewish city of Yamit. In 1972, General Ezer Weizman, later president, added that a political settlement without expansion would mean that Israel could not exist according to the scale, spirit, and quality she now embodies. The crucial question was how Washington would react. After internal debate, the government abandoned its official policy in favor of Kissinger's principle of stalemate. No diplomacy, only force. It should be recalled that this was a period of extreme triumphalism, later greatly regretted in Israel. The U.S. and Israel took it for granted after 1967 that Arabs could pose no military threat. The Egyptian peace offer is not famous in the U.S., rather unknown, a common fate of events that do not conform to doctrinal requirements. Sadat still hoped to gain U.S. acquiescence by expelling his Russian advisors and other moves. He also warned that Yamit means war. He was not taken seriously. In 1973, he did launch a war, which was a near disaster for Israel, and also led to a nuclear alert in the U.S. At that point, Kissinger realized that Egypt could not simply be dismissed and launched his shuttle diplomacy, which led finally to the Camp David settlement of 1978 and 1979. At Camp David, the U.S. and Israel accepted Sadat's 1971 offer, but on terms much less favorable from their point of view. By then, the fate of the Palestinians had become an issue, and Sadat joined most of the rest of the world in insisting on their rights. These events are hailed as a U.S. diplomatic triumph. Jimmy Carter won the Nobel Peace Prize, primarily for the culminating achievement. The entire process was, in reality, a diplomatic catastrophe. The U.S.-Israel rejection of diplomacy led to a terrible war, great suffering, and a superpower confrontation that could have gotten out of hand. But one of the prerogatives of power is the ability to write history with confidence that there will be little challenge. The disaster therefore enters history as a grand triumph of the U.S.-run peace process. Israel recognized at once that with the Arab deterrent removed, it could intensify its expansion into the occupied territories and attack its northern neighbor, as it proceeded to do in 1978 and 1982, continuing to occupy parts of Lebanon for almost 20 years. The 1982 invasion and its immediate aftermath left some 20,000 dead. According to Lebanese sources, the toll in the following years was about 25,000. The topic is of little concern in the West, on the principle that crimes for which we are responsible require no inquiry, let alone punishment or reparations. After many bombings and other provocations failed to elicit a pretext for the planned 1982 invasion, Israel finally seized upon the attempted assassination of its ambassador in London by the terrorist group headed by Abu Nidal, who had been condemned to death by the PLO and had been at war with it for years. Resort to this pretext was acceptable to articulate American opinion, which also had no problem with Israel's immediate response, an attack on the Sabra Shatila Palestinian refugee camps in Beirut, where 200 people were killed, according to a reliable American observer. UN attempts to halt the aggression were blocked by immediate U.S. vetoes. So matters continued through 18 bloody years of Israeli atrocities in Lebanon, rarely with even a thin pretext of self-defense. Chief of Staff Raful Eitan echoed the common understanding in Israel when he at once declared the 1982 invasion to be a success because it weakened the political status of the PLO and set back its struggle for a Palestinian state. Leading U.S. intellectuals also welcomed the political defeat of the PLO, clearly recognizing that to be the goal of the war while anointing it a just war, as Michael Walzer said. Most public commentary and media, however, preferred tales about unprovoked rocket attacks on innocent Israelis and similar fabrications, though by now the truth is sometimes recognized. New York Times correspondent James Bennett writes that the goal of the 1982 invasion was to install a friendly regime and destroy Mr. Arafat's Palestinian Liberation Organization. That, the theory went, would help persuade Palestinians to accept Israeli rule in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. To my knowledge, this is the first report in the American mainstream of what was well known in Israel and has been published in marginalized dissident circles in the U.S. for 20 years. It is also a textbook illustration of massive international terrorism, if not the more severe crime of aggression, tracing right back to Washington, which provided the requisite economic, military, and diplomatic support. Without such authorization and aid, Israel can do very little. There are many illusions about this in the Arab countries and elsewhere. Particularly for the victims, it is not wise to live with illusions. On the diplomatic front, by the mid-1970s, U.S.-Israeli isolation increased as the Palestinian issue entered the international agenda. In 1976, the U.S. vetoed a resolution calling for a Palestinian state alongside Israel, incorporating the basic wording of UN Resolution 242 from 1967. From then to the present, the U.S. has blocked the possibility of a diplomatic settlement in the terms accepted by virtually the entire world, a two-state settlement on the international border, with minor and mutual adjustments. That was the principle of official, though not actual, U.S. policy, until the Clinton administration formally abandoned the framework of international diplomacy, declaring UN resolutions obsolete and anachronistic. It is noteworthy that the U.S. stand is also opposed by most of the U.S. population. A large majority support the Saudi plan, proposed in early 2002 and accepted by the Arab League, which offered full recognition and integration of Israel into the region in exchange for withdrawal to the 1967 borders. Yet another version of the long-standing international consensus that the U.S. has blocked. Large majorities also believe that the U.S. should equalize aid to Israel and the Palestinians under a negotiated settlement, and should cut aid to either party that refuses to negotiate, meaning, at the time of the poll, that it should cut aid to Israel. But few understand what any of this implies, and almost nothing is reported about it. After the first Gulf War, Washington felt that it was in a position to impose its own preferred solution. Although never fully elaborated, the 1991 version was to be more forthcoming than the administration position announced in December 1989, which endorsed without qualifications the Israeli coalition government plan stipulating that there can be no additional Palestinian state, Jordan already being a Palestinian state in their conception, and that the fate of the territories will be determined in accordance with the basic guidelines of the Israeli government. Washington convened the Madrid conference, with Russian participation to offer a fig leaf of internationalism. But a problem arose at the conference. The Palestinian delegation was headed by Haider Abd al-Shafi, a conservative nationalist known for his integrity and one of the most respected Palestinian figures. The delegation refused to agree to continued Israeli settlement programs in the occupied territories, thus deadlocking the negotiations, because the U.S. and Israel refused to agree to this condition, even to consider it seriously. Recognizing that his public support was collapsing within the territories and the Palestinian diaspora, Yasser Arafat undercut the Palestinian delegation by secret negotiations with Israel, leading to the Oslo process, initiated officially without much pomp in September 1993 at the White House. The wording of the Oslo agreements made it clear that they were a mandate for continued Israeli settlement programs, as the Israeli leadership, Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres, took no pains to conceal. For that reason, Abd al-Shafi refused to have anything to do with the official peace process. So matters proceeded through the 1990s, as Israeli settlement and integration of the territories proceeded steadily, with full U.S. support. In 2000, the final year of Clinton's term, and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak's, settlement reached its highest peak since 1992, striking further blows at the possibility of a resolution of the conflict by peaceful diplomatic means. Camp David II and beyond, toward a permanent neocolonial dependency. U.S.-Israeli rejectionism runs through the Camp David negotiations of 2000. The conventional image is that Clinton and Barak made a magnanimous offer of unparalleled generosity, but the treacherous Palestinians turned it down, preferring violence. There's a simple way to evaluate these claims. Present a map of the territorial settlement proposed. No map has been found in U.S. media or journals, apart from scholarly sources and the dissident literature. A look at the maps reveals that the Clinton-Barak offer virtually divided the West Bank into three cantons, effectively separated from one another by two salients consisting of expansive Jewish settlement and infrastructure developments. The three cantons have only limited access to East Jerusalem, the center of Palestinian commercial, cultural, and political life, and all are separated from Gaza. Admittedly, this would have been an improvement over the status quo, with Palestinians in the West Bank confined to more than 200 cantons, some a few square kilometers, and the situation in the Gaza Strip was in many ways worse. Shortly before joining the Barak government and becoming the chief negotiator at Camp David, Shlomo Ben-Ami, considered a dove in the Israeli spectrum, published an academic study in which he outlined the goal of the Oslo peace process, to establish a neocolonial dependency for the Palestinians, which will be permanent. That is essentially what was offered at Camp David. In Israel, maps did appear in the mainstream press, and the proposals are commonly described as modeled on South Africa's Bantustans of 40 years ago. Respected commentators report that the South African model was considered very seriously in high military and political echelons in the 1970s and 1980s, and is the model today. Israel also considered South Africa a valued ally, as did the U.S. through the Reagan years. After the failure of Camp David 2000, negotiations continued. They led to high-level but unofficial meetings at Taba, Egypt, in January 2001. These appeared to be making considerable progress, though the major territorial problems remained, in less extreme forms. There is a careful record of the Tava negotiations in a report by the European Union observer, Miguel Moratinos, approved by both sides. The basic differences were narrowed, but not entirely bridged. For the West Bank, there was agreement in principle on the long-standing international consensus honoring the internationally recognized border, with minor and mutual adjustments, now not so minor, because of the U.S.-backed Israeli settlement and infrastructure programs that, as noted, rapidly expanded as the Oslo process proceeded on its largely predictable course. Palestinian negotiators at Taba agreed to include within Israel the post-Oslo settlements established around the vastly expanded Jerusalem, but called for a one-to-one territorial swap with the support of some Israeli hawks, who welcomed the opportunity to transfer Israeli Arabs out of the country, thus relieving the much-feared demographic problem, too many non-Jews in a Jewish state. But the Israeli negotiators insisted on a two-to-one, or larger, swap in their favor, with Palestinians offered a worthless area adjacent to the Sinai Desert. The primary territorial issue remained the status of the Israeli town of Ma'el Adumim to the east of Jerusalem, and the infrastructure linking it to the expanded areas to be annexed to Israel, developed mostly in the 1990s with the clear intent of virtually bisecting the West Bank. These issues remained unresolved, along with some others, but there is good reason to accept Akiva Eldar's conclusion that progress was real and promising, even if not formal. The negotiations were called off by Barak prior to the Israeli elections, and in the face of escalating violence were never resumed, so we cannot know where they might have led. The basic issues were reviewed by Hussein Aga and Robert Malley, two well-informed commentators in foreign affairs. They observed, accurately, that the outlines of a solution have basically been understood for some time now, a territorial divide on the international border with a one-to-one land swap. They write that the way to get to the solution has eluded all sides from the start. But while accurate, the statement is misleading. The way has been blocked for 25 years by the United States, and Israel continues to reject it, even at the dovish extreme of the mainstream political spectrum, as the Moratinos report again documents. During the George W. Bush, Ariel Sharon years, the prospects for a diplomatic solution have declined further. Israel has expanded its settlement programs with continued U.S. backing. The Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, was finally able to obtain official maps indicating Israeli territorial intentions. Israeli settlements now control 42% of the West Bank. The boundaries of Ma'el Adumim, for example, reach from the area of Greater Jerusalem almost to the isolated Palestinian town of Jericho, a salient that largely isolates the southern region of the West Bank. Another salient to the north also remains, partially separating the northern from the central sectors. The result is a harsh version of the three-canton arrangement for the West Bank, all virtually separated from a small part of East Jerusalem, and of course from Gaza, however its fate is determined. The situation in 2003 is described in the primary U.S. scholarly source on the settlements by its editor, Jeffrey Aronson, after a visit to the southern area. In virtually every Israeli settlement, colonization efforts are proceeding apace, leading to revolutionary changes in patterns of transportation and access, aimed at consolidating Israel's ability to secure a permanent hold over these lands, integrated within the much-expanded Israel. In contrast, the dynamic for Palestinians is just the opposite, an ever-increasing network of barricades, obstacles, patrol roads, and prohibitions that isolate them from settlements, from each other, and from places of work, compromising their ability to lead normal lives and impoverishing an entire national community. As for Bush administration plans in mid-2003, there are two sources, rhetoric and action. At the rhetorical level, one reads of Bush's vision of a Palestinian state and the U.S.-inspired roadmap. In the real world, the Bush administration repeatedly blocked public release of the roadmap of the quartet, EU, UN, Russia, U.S., much to the annoyance of the other members. The vision was left vague, and remained so after the roadmap was finally released, accompanied by Bush's modest announcement that the roadmap represents a starting point toward achieving the vision of two states that I set out on June 24, 2002, namely a pale and indistinct version of the vision that had been common coin for over a quarter century, but blocked by the U.S. The first steps on the roadmap are explicit. Palestinians must immediately terminate resistance to the occupation, including attacks on Israeli soldiers in the occupied territories, and Israel must declare its commitment to the two-state vision expressed by President Bush, its nature unclear. As comprehensive security performance moves forward, IDF withdraws progressively from areas occupied since September 28, 2000, and the two sides restore the status quo that existed at the time. Satisfactory performance will be determined by Israel and Washington. The status quo that is to be restored leaves Palestinians confined to hundreds of cantons, surrounded by the settlements and infrastructure constructed by the U.S.-backed Israeli military occupation. The future of these settlements remains unclear. Israel immediately dismantles settlement outposts erected since March 2001, something on which all but the ultra-right in Israel agree. And at some time left unspecified, Israel freezes all settlement activity, including natural growth of settlements. Until that time, the settlements can continue to expand. If the time for freezing ever comes, the Bantustan-style arrangements instituted through the 1990s, in the context of the U.S.-Israeli peace process, continued under the roadmap, will presumably be well established. Later still, there is to be implementation of prior agreements to enhance maximum territorial contiguity for the Palestinian state, including further action on settlements. The further action remains unspecified. There are no prior agreements that yield meaningful territorial contiguity. The only serious proposals that have been made are not on the agenda. Whatever Bush's two-state vision may be, it is apparently not the two-state vision supported by virtually the entire world that the U.S. has blocked since the mid-1970s, nor the Saudi plan ratified by the Arab League and supported by a majority of the American population, nor the solution whose outlines have basically been understood for some time now, described by Aga and Mali. There is no hint of any of these ideas. Furthermore, although there is immediate and violent enforcement of the roadmap's conditions on the Palestinians, there is no enforcement of conditions on the U.S.-funded Israeli settlement and development programs. There is a rich record about all of this, and no reason to expect any significant change. Though the political roadmap remains vague with regard to Israel's responsibilities, other demands are quite specific. The huge U.S. subsidy to Israel is, for the first time, conditioned on Israel's performance, not on its implementation of the terms of the roadmap, but on an economic plan that will slash public sector jobs and wages and lower taxes, measures that have been dubbed an economic roadmap. The plan is described by Israel's leading newspaper as a new theory, according to which the U.S. openly intervenes in forcing a neoliberal order in Israel, a theory that is welcome to the Israeli business sector, but led immediately to a strike of 700,000 workers. Also quite specific are operations to create facts on the ground while talk proceeds, in the traditional manner. Notable among them is the construction of the separation wall that incorporates parts of the West Bank within Israel. The justification offered for the barrier is security, for Israelis, not Palestinians, whose security problems are far more grave. A barrier with a land swap would provide no less security. The most security would be given by a wall a few miles inside Israel to allow the IDF to patrol fully on both sides. But such proposals would not incorporate Palestinian land within Israel and would disrupt the lives of Israelis rather than Palestinians and are therefore unthinkable. World Bank-sponsored reports conclude that the wall will leave almost 100,000 Palestinians on the Israeli side, along with some of the richest agricultural land in the West Bank. The wall also places a good part of the vitally important West Bank aquifer under Israeli control. One West Bank town, Qalqilya, is already virtually surrounded by the wall, cut off from its lands, 30% of its water supplies, and whatever territories will be assigned someday to the viable Palestinian state with territorial contiguity. More than half of Qalqilya's agricultural lands were reported to have been confiscated, to be annexed to Israel, with the munificent offer of one-time compensation equal to the market price of 1 year's harvest. Immediately after Colin Powell went to Israel to meet with Prime Minister Sharon and discuss the roadmap, Sharon informed the press that as the wall proceeded south of Qalqilya, it would sweep well to the east to enclose the Israeli settlements of Ariel and Emmanuel, thereby partially separating the northern Palestinian enclave from the central one by a salient of Israeli settlements and infrastructure, as in the Clinton-Barack Camp David plan. There can be little doubt that the second and more important of the Clinton-Barack extensions of Israeli territory, dividing the central enclave from the southern one, will also be incorporated, de facto, within Israel in some manner. There is also little reason to doubt that Israeli communities that remain outside the wall will retain their current status as, effectively, parts of Israel, linked to it by large-scale infrastructure, protected by the IDF, and free to expand within their allotted territory until some order to the contrary comes from above. The very well-informed Harvard University scholar Sarah Roy, relying on internal sources, writes that the World Bank estimates that some 232,000 people living in 72 communities will be affected by the first northern phase of the wall's construction, with 140,000 living on the eastern side of the wall, but, in effect, encircled within its winding path, and that completion could isolate as many as 250,000 to 300,000 Palestinians, while annexing as much as 10% of the West Bank to Israel. She suggests further that the wall's design may be aimed at carving out and encircling the 42% or less of the West Bank that Sharon has said he is prepared to cede to a Palestinian state. If so, Sharon may have in mind something like the plan he proposed in 1992, now recognizing that the political spectrum has shifted so far toward the extremist nationalist pole that what seemed audacious then may be portrayed as a dramatic concession today. The facts on the ground, Israeli journalist Amira Haas comments, are determining and will continue to determine the area where the roadmap will be applied, the area where the entity known as the Palestinian State will be established. A visit to the places where the Public Works Commission, the Defense Ministry, Housing Ministry, and the IDF bulldozers are busy at work makes it possible to see why it's easy for Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to talk about a Palestinian state. The massive construction in Jerusalem and its environs, from Bethlehem to Ramallah and the Dead Sea to Modi'in, has already ruled out any Palestinian urban, industrial, or cultural development worthy of the name in the area of East Jerusalem. The southern enclave of the West Bank, from Hebron to Bethlehem, will be cut off from the central enclave of the Ramallah area by an ocean of manicured Israeli settlements, tunnel roads, and highways. The northern enclave, from Jenin to Nablus, will be cut off from the center by the massive settlement block of Ariel Eli Shiloh. As for the settlement freeze, when Sharon persuaded his extremist cabinet to accept the roadmap, he explained that there is no restriction here, and you can build for your children and grandchildren, and I hope for your great-grandchildren as well. At the rhetorical level, the roadmap appears to offer more to the Palestinians than the Oslo process. It uses such terms as Palestinian state, end to the occupation, freeze on all settlement activity, etc., all phrases missing from the Oslo protocols. But the appearance is deceptive. Apart from extremist elements, Israel and its sponsors have no intention of taking over territories beyond useful and desirable limits, or of having Israel administer the bulk of the Palestinian population. Construction of facts on the ground has proceeded sufficiently to allow the free use of terms that might previously have impeded plans that had been implemented for the past decade and are now being established more firmly. Apart from the rhetoric about visions, there is a more significant source of information: actions. Keeping just to a few illustrations, in December 2000, the Bush administration caused some consternation abroad when it vetoed a Security Council resolution advanced by the European Union, calling for implementation of Washington's Mitchell Plan and efforts to reduce violence by the dispatch of international monitors, to which Israel strongly objects. Their presence is likely to reduce Palestinian violence, but would also impede Israeli repression and terror. 10 days before the veto, Washington boycotted a conference in Geneva of the high contracting parties of the Geneva Conventions, called to review the situation in the occupied territories. The boycott yielded the usual double veto. The decisions are blocked, and the events are barely reported and erased from history. The conference reaffirmed the applicability of the Fourth Geneva Convention to the occupied territories, so that many U.S.-Israeli actions there are war crimes under U.S. law. The conference again condemned U.S.-funded Israeli settlements, and the practice of willful killing, torture, unlawful deportation, willful depriving of the rights of fair and regular trial, extensive destruction and appropriation of property, carried out unlawfully and wantonly. The Fourth Geneva Convention, instituted to criminalize formally the crimes of the Nazis in occupied Europe, is a core principle of international humanitarian law. Its applicability to the Israeli occupied territories has repeatedly been affirmed, among other occasions, by UN Ambassador George Bush, September 1971, and by Security Council resolutions. These include Resolution 465, 1980, adopted unanimously, which condemned U.S.-backed Israeli practices as flagrant violations of the convention, and Resolution 1322, October 2000, passed 14-0, with the U.S. abstaining, which called on Israel to abide scrupulously by its responsibilities under the Fourth Geneva Convention. As high contracting parties, the U.S. and the European powers are obligated by solemn treaty to apprehend and prosecute those responsible for such crimes, including their own leadership. By continuing to reject that duty, they are enhancing terror, to borrow George W. Bush's words condemning Palestinians. The U.S. stance has shifted over the years from endorsement of the applicability of the conventions to the occupied territories to abstention during the Clinton years, and finally to undermining them under George W. Bush. The Bush administration signaled its tacit endorsement of violent repression in the occupied territories in other ways as well. Thus, while Ariel Sharon was conducting his brutal offensive in the West Bank in April 2002, Colin Powell was sent to bring peace. He meandered through the Mediterranean, arriving in Israel just as the defenders of Jenin were running out of food and ammunition. One may presume that State Department intelligence was able to work out that calculation. A Pentagon official stated the obvious. Powell's itinerary, he said, was designed to give Sharon some more time. A State Department official added that the Israelis are not listening so much to what we say, but are watching what we do. And what we're doing is giving them more time to withdraw when they finish their work, leveling the refugee camp at Jenin, smashing much of the old city of Nablus, and destroying the institutional and cultural infrastructure of Palestinian life in Ramallah with the viciousness that has been IDF practice for many years. In December 2002, the UN General Assembly reiterated the near-universal opposition to Israel's effective annexation of Jerusalem, in defiance of Security Council resolutions going back to 1968, passed with U.S. support. For the first time, the U.S. voted against the resolution, formally reversing the long-standing official U.S. position on the status of Jerusalem. The U.S. was joined by Israel, several Pacific Island dependencies, and Costa Rica. If intended seriously, this reversal virtually eliminates the possibility of a political settlement. The Bush administration also continued to sustain violence by voting against a resolution calling for international efforts to halt the deteriorating situation between Israel and the Palestinians, reverse all measures taken on the ground since the latest violence began in September 2000, and push for a peace agreement, passed 160-4, the U.S. joined by Israel, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. Following the conventional pattern, none of this seems to have been reported in the U.S. Bush also declared the arch-terrorist Sharon a man of peace and demanded that Arafat be replaced by a prime minister who will meet U.S.-Israeli demands, though, unlike Mr. Arafat, he does not have a popular following. All of this provides further illustration of the president's vision of democracy. In February 2003, Bush delivered what the New York Times called his first significant remarks about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in 8 months, in a speech to the far-right American Enterprise Institute. The speech was mostly vacuous, but it did indeed contain one significant remark. Bush declared obliquely that Israel could continue its programs of settlement and development in the occupied territories. The form of his endorsement was the statement that, as progress is made toward peace, settlement activity in the occupied territories must end, implying that it can continue until the U.S. determines, unilaterally, as always, that progress has been made. Again, Bush's sole significant remark reverses official government policy. Previously, the settlement programs had been considered illegal, or at least unhelpful. Now they are implicitly authorized. In defense of the administration, one may argue that official doctrine has been brought into conformity with near-invariant practice. Prevailing values are often expressed implicitly, as on the first anniversary of 9/11, when the president took the occasion to provide $200 million in supplemental funding for the rich country of Israel, while rejecting $130 million for emergency supplemental aid to Afghanistan. And not only in the U.S., thus, former U.K. Foreign Secretary Douglas Lord Hurd wrote that two unsolved problems torment the Middle East, the danger from Saddam Hussein and the insecurity of Israel. The insecurity of Palestinians in the 36th year of military occupation is not an unsolved problem. In fact, it remains unmentioned. The steps that undermine the prospects for a peaceful diplomatic settlement are continually justified as a response to Palestinian terror, which did indeed escalate, including terrible crimes against Israeli civilians during the Al-Aqsa Intifada that broke out at the end of September 2000. The Intifada also brought into the open significant changes that had been taking place within Israel. The authority of the Israeli military by then reached such levels that military correspondent Ben Caspit described the country as not a state with an army, but an army with a state. Caspit's analysis is basically confirmed and deepened historically by another prominent military correspondent, Reuven Pedatzur, reviewing Israel's culture of power and consistent choice of the military option over peaceful means since its founding. In his discussion of a book by military historian Mati Golani, Pedatzur writes that Golani is, of course, correct in his bald denial of the sacrosanct Israeli ethos according to which Israel has always aspired to peace, whereas its neighbors have consistently refused to tread the path of peace, choosing the path of war instead. The facts are sharply different. Both agree. One prime reason is the institutionalization of power and its total transfer to the responsibility of the political and military establishments. The military command intervenes in political diplomatic debate, sometimes by threat of force, effectively formulating policy to an extent unknown in any other democratic society. Guided by this military culture, Israel's political military leadership uses fear-mongering tactics in security issues, generating anxiety in order to mobilize Israeli society and to deflect the public's gaze from domestic problems, such as a deteriorating economic situation or a growing unemployment rate. The formula, familiar enough elsewhere, including the U.S., was established by Israel's founding father David Ben-Gurion in the earliest days of the state, and fear-mongering would be used in the following decades to the present. Author and reviewer join other Israeli commentators in warning of the serious danger of the formation of a consensus, according to which, in Israel's situation, democratic considerations are a luxury, with signs of fascism. Caspit's observations were motivated by the utter contempt shown by the military command for the orders of the civilian government in the early months of the Intifada, a stance that is particularly noteworthy, since the Prime Minister was a former chief of staff and other civilian officials were also from the upper military echelons. Like other powerful military forces facing largely defenseless opponents, the IDF instantly resorted to extreme violence. When the head of military intelligence requested an inquiry into how many bullets the IDF fired from the start of the hostilities, he and other generals were shocked to learn that in the first few days of the Intifada, the IDF fired 1 million bullets and other projectiles, a bullet for each child, one officer of the high command commented with disgust. Military sources confirmed a report that in one incident, a single shot, fired in the air to illustrate the reality to a European observer, evoked 2 solid hours of intense fire from Israeli troops and tanks. According to IDF accounting, the ratio of Palestinian to Israeli dead was almost 20 to 1 in the first month of the Intifada, 75 Palestinians, 4 Israelis, in areas under military occupation, with resistance scarcely going beyond stone throwing. The Army's force of huge, U.S.-provided bulldozers was also called into action to destroy dwellings, fields, olive groves, and forests with utter abandon, following policies that have made Israel synonymous with bulldozer, one correspondent wrote with dismay, reversing founding ideals about making the desert bloom. From the outset, Israel used U.S. military helicopters to attack civilian targets, killing and wounding dozens of people. Clinton responded instantly with the largest deal in a decade for military helicopters. There were no constraints on use, the Pentagon informed journalists. The facts, well known at once, were unreported in the U.S. Israel was breaking no new ground. U.S. forces in the Gulf War in 1991 enjoyed such overwhelming military superiority that troops could enter Iraq behind plows mounted on tanks and earth movers, which bulldozed live Iraqi soldiers into trenches in the desert, an unprecedented tactic, Patrick Sloyan reported. Not a single American was killed during the attack that made an Iraqi body count impossible. The victims were mostly Shiite and Kurdish peasant conscripts, it appears, hapless victims of Saddam Hussein, hiding in holes in the sand or fleeing for their lives. The report elicited little interest or comment. Such slaughters are not only routine when there is an overwhelming disparity of force, but are often lauded by the perpetrators. To select an illustration concerning the non-Muslim member of the Axis of Evil, it is unlikely that North Koreans have forgotten the object lesson in air power to all the communists in the world, and especially to the communists in North Korea, that was delivered in May 1953, a month before the armistice, and reported enthusiastically in a U.S. Air Force study. There were no targets left in the flattened country, so U.S. bombers were dispatched to destroy irrigation dams furnishing 75% of the controlled rice supply for North Korea's rice production. The Westerner can little conceive the awesome meaning which the loss of this staple commodity has for the Asian. Starvation and slow death, the official account continues, recounting the kinds of crimes that led to death sentences at Nuremberg. One may wonder whether such memories are in the background as the desperate North Korean leadership plays nuclear chicken. It is important to be aware of how routine these practices are, hence how likely they are to recur unless inhibited from within the powerful states. We can observe with horror the ruins of Grozny, and if historical memory is allowed, can recall the devastation left by U.S. saturation bombing in Indochina. Revenge knows few limits when the privileged and powerful are subjected to the kind of terror they regularly mete out to their victims. To take an example from earlier years, when British citizens were murdered in the course of a rebellion in occupied India 150 years ago, the Indian Mutiny in imperial parlance, Britain's reaction was ferocious. It was a ghastly and horrible picture showing man at his worst, Nehru wrote from his prison cell during World War II, citing British and Indian sources, the latter banned under the Raj. A current scholarly history records the common practice of wanton attacks on passive villagers and unarmed Indians, even faithful domestic servants, brutal murder of captured mutineers, entire villages put to the torch for the crime of proximity to the site of real or alleged Indian atrocities, as a terrible racial ferocity erupted and inspired British vengeance. Another describes how tens of thousands of soldiers and village guerrillas were hanged, shot, or blown from guns, leading to a significant drop in population in several regions. The tone is illustrated by the advice in May 1857 by John Nicholson, the hero of Delhi, an upright man and professed Christian, according to his contemporary admirers. Let us propose a bill for the flaying alive, impalement, or burning of the murderers of the women and children at Delhi. The idea of simply hanging the perpetrators of such atrocities is maddening. The atrocities to which he referred included those revealed in detailed but imaginary accounts of other righteous Christians who carried out unspeakable atrocities in revenge. To illustrate the impact of the sobering lessons of World War II, in Kenya in the 1950s, some 150,000 people died in the course of Britain's repression of a colonial revolt, a campaign conducted with hideous terror and atrocities, but, as always, guided by the highest ideals. The British governor had explained to the people of Kenya in 1946 that Britain controls their land and resources as of right, the product of historical events which reflect the greatest glory of our fathers and grandfathers. If the greater part of the wealth of the country is at present in our hands, that is because this land we have made is our land by right of achievement, and Africans will simply have to learn to live in a world which we have made, under the humanitarian impulses of the late 19th and the 20th century. History is replete with precedents for what we see before our eyes, day after day, though the stakes grow more awesome along with the means of destruction available. Israeli commanders rely not only on the standard military doctrine of those who have overwhelming force at their command, but also on their own experience. When they ordered massive violence to crush Palestinians with cruel collective punishment in October 2000, they probably did not anticipate that the tactics would arouse the victims to bloody revenge. That did not happen when Prime Minister Rabin sent his troops to crush the population of the territories by breaking bones, beatings, torture, and humiliation during the first Intifada a decade earlier. Then the tactics largely worked, as they had in the past. In December 1982, after an outburst of settler and IDF terror and atrocities in the territories that shocked even Israeli hawks, a prominent Israeli academic specialist on military affairs warned of the dangers to Israeli society when 750,000 young people who have served in the IDF know that the task of the army is not only to defend the state in the battlefield against a foreign army, but to demolish the rights of innocent people just because they are Arabushim, living in territories that God promised to us. The essential principle had been formulated in the early years of the occupation by Moshe Dayan. Israel should tell the Palestinians in the territories that we have no solution. You shall continue to live like dogs, and whoever wishes may leave, and we will see where this process leads. But the Palestinians remained Samidin, who endured but scarcely retaliated. The second Intifada was different. This time the orders to crush Palestinians relentlessly and teach them not to raise their heads escalated the cycle of violence, spilling into Israel itself, which had lost the substantial immunity to retaliation from within the territories that had prevailed for more than three decades of military occupation. Echoing the concerns of 20 years earlier, an editorial in Israel's leading daily concluded that 2.5 years of intense fighting against Palestinian terrorism have turned the Israel Defense Forces into an obdurate and callous army, focused on its mission out of an indifference to the consequences of its actions. The IDF, which brought up generations of soldiers on the myth of purity of arms and educated its commanders with the idea of the moral, deliberating soldier who takes tough decisions while thinking of humane considerations, is turning into a killing machine whose efficiency is awe-inspiring, yet shocking. As the official ratio of Palestinians to Israelis killed moved from 20 to 1 to close to 3 to 1, attitudes in the U.S. changed from inattention to atrocities or support for them to extreme outrage at the atrocities directed at innocent U.S. clients. These were indeed outrageous. The selective vision, however, speaks for itself, not least because of its deep roots in the culture and history of conquerors. Chapter 8, Terrorism and Justice, Some Useful Truisms. On a highly controversial topic like the one we turn to now, perhaps it is a good idea to begin with a few simple truths. The first is that actions are evaluated in terms of the range of likely consequences. A second is the principle of universality. We apply to ourselves the same standards we apply to others, if not more stringent ones. Apart from being the merest truisms, these principles are also the foundation of just war theory, at least any version of it that deserves to be taken seriously. The truisms raise an empirical question. Are they accepted? Investigation will reveal, I believe, that they are rejected almost without exception. The first truism may merit a word of elaboration. The actual consequences of an action may be highly significant, but they do not bear on the moral evaluation of the action. No one celebrates Khrushchev's success in placing nuclear missiles in Cuba because it did not lead to nuclear war, or condemns the fearmongers who warned of the threat. Nor do we applaud North Korea's dear leader for developing nuclear weapons and providing missile technology to Pakistan, or denounce those who warn of possible consequences because they haven't taken place. An apologist for state violence who took such positions would be regarded as a moral monster or lunatic. That's obvious until it comes time to apply the same criteria to ourselves. Then the stance of the lunatic or moral monster is taken to be highly honorable, indeed obligatory, and adherence to the truisms is condemned with horror. Let us nevertheless accept the truisms for what they are, truisms, and then think about a few crucial current cases to which they apply. Truisms and terror. Take 9/11. It is widely argued that the terrorist attacks changed everything dramatically as the world entered a new and frightening Age of Terror, the title of a collection of academic essays by Yale University scholars and others. It is also widely held that the term terror is very hard to define. We might ask why the concept of terror should be considered particularly obscure. There are official U.S. government definitions that fall well within the range of clarity of other usages that are regarded as unproblematic. A U.S. Army manual defined terrorism as the calculated use of violence or threat of violence to attain goals that are political, religious, or ideological in nature, through intimidation, coercion, or instilling fear. The official U.S. code gave a more elaborate definition, essentially along the same lines. The British government's definition is similar. Terrorism is the use or threat of action which is violent, damaging, or disrupting, and is intended to influence the government or intimidate the public, and is for the purpose of advancing a political, religious, or ideological cause. These definitions seem fairly clear. They are close enough to ordinary usage, and are considered appropriate when discussing the terrorism of enemies. The official U.S. definitions are the ones I've been using in writing about the topic since the Reagan administration came into office in 1981, declaring that a war on terror would be a centerpiece of its foreign policy. The reliance on these definitions is particularly appropriate for our purposes because they were formulated when the first war on terror was declared, but almost no one uses them, and they have been rescinded, replaced by nothing sensible. The reasons do not seem obscure. The official definitions of terrorism are virtually the same as the definitions of counter-terror, sometimes called low-intensity conflict or counterinsurgency. But counter-terror is official U.S. policy, and it plainly will not do to say that the U.S. is officially committed to terrorism. The U.S. is by no means alone in this practice. It is traditional for states to call their own terrorism counter-terror, even the worst mass murderers, the Nazis, for example. In occupied Europe, they claim to be defending the population and legitimate governments from the partisans, terrorists supported from abroad. That was not entirely false. Even the most egregious propaganda rarely is. The partisans were undoubtedly directed from London, and they did engage in terror. The U.S. military had some appreciation of the Nazi perspective. Its counterinsurgency doctrine was modeled on Nazi manuals, which were analyzed sympathetically with the assistance of Wehrmacht officers. It is this common practice that allows for the conventional thesis that terror is a weapon of the weak. That is true, by definition, if terror is restricted to their terrorism. If the doctrinal requirement is lifted, however, we find that, like most weapons, terror is primarily a weapon of the powerful. Another problem with the official definitions of terror is that it follows from them that the U.S. is a leading terrorist state. That much is hardly controversial, at least among those who believe that we should pay some attention to such institutions as the International Court of Justice or the UN Security Council, or mainstream scholarship, as the examples of Nicaragua and Cuba unequivocally reveal. But that conclusion won't do either. So we are left with no sensible definition of terrorism, unless we decide to break ranks and use the official definitions that have been abandoned because of their unacceptable consequences. The official definitions do not answer every question precisely. They do not, for example, draw a sharp boundary between international terrorism and aggression, or between terror and resistance. These issues have arisen in interesting ways, which have direct bearing on the redeclared war on terror and on today's headlines. Take the distinction between terror and resistance. One question that arises is the legitimacy of actions to realize the right to self-determination, freedom, and independence, as derived from the Charter of the United Nations, of people forcibly deprived of that right, particularly peoples under colonial and racist regimes and foreign occupation. Do such actions fall under terror or resistance? The quoted words are from the most forceful denunciation of the crime of terrorism by the UN General Assembly, which stated further that nothing in the present resolution could in any way prejudice the right so defined. The resolution was adopted in December 1987, just as officially recognized international terrorism reached its peak. It is obviously important. The vote was 153-2, with a single abstention, Honduras, hence even more important. The two countries that voted against the resolution were the usual ones. Their reason, they explained at the UN session, was the paragraph just quoted. The phrase, colonial and racist regimes, was understood to refer to their ally, apartheid South Africa. Evidently, the US and Israel could not condone resistance to the apartheid regime, particularly when it was led by Mandela's African National Congress, one of the world's more notorious terrorist groups, as Washington determined at the time. The other phrase, foreign occupation, was understood to refer to Israel's military occupation, then in its 20th year. Evidently, resistance could not be condoned in that case either. The U.S. and Israel were alone in the world in denying that such actions can be legitimate resistance and declaring them to be terrorism. The U.S.-Israeli stand extends beyond the occupied territories. Thus, the U.S. and Israel regard Hezbollah, for example, as one of the leading terrorist organizations in the world, not because of its terrorist acts, which are real, but because it was formed to resist the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon and succeeded in driving out the invaders after two decades of defiance of Security Council orders to withdraw. The U.S. even goes so far as to call people terrorists if they resist direct U.S. aggression, the South Vietnamese, for example, or recently, the Iraqis. The public knows nothing about the major UN condemnation of what Reagan called the evil scourge of terrorism and its fate by virtue of the usual double veto. To learn about such matters, one has to wander into forbidden territory, the historical and documentary record, or marginalized critical literature. Despite the unclarities and the sharp divide between the U.S., Israel, and the world, the official U.S. definitions of terror seem fairly adequate to the purposes at hand. Let us turn to the belief that 9/11 signaled a sharp change in the course of history. That seems questionable. Nonetheless, something dramatically new and different did happen on that terrible day. The target was not Cuba, or Nicaragua, or Lebanon, or Chechnya, or one of the other traditional victims of international terrorism, but a state with enormous power to shape the future. For the first time, an attack on the rich and powerful countries succeeded on a scale that is, regrettably, not unfamiliar in their traditional domains. Alongside horror at the crime against humanity and sympathy for the victims, commentators outside the ranks of Western privilege often responded to the 9/11 atrocities with a welcome to the club, particularly in Latin America, where it is not so easy to forget the plague of violence and repression that swept through the region from the early 1960s, or its roots. The plague can in part be traced to a decision by the Kennedy administration in 1962 to change the mission of the Latin American military, effectively from hemispheric defense to internal security. The effect was a shift from toleration of the rapacity and cruelty of the Latin American military to direct complicity in their crimes, to support for the methods of Heinrich Himmler's extermination squads, in the words of Charles Makeling, who led U.S. counterinsurgency and internal defense planning from 1961 to 1966. The perception of the victims is similar. To take one case of unusual current significance, the highly respected president of the Colombian Permanent Committee for Human Rights, Alfredo Vasquez Carrizosa, writes that the Kennedy administration took great pains to transform our regular armies into counterinsurgency brigades, accepting the new strategy of the death squads, ushering in what is known in Latin America as the national security doctrine, not defense against an external enemy, but a way to make the military establishment the masters of the game with the right to combat the internal enemy. It is the right to fight and to exterminate social workers, trade unionists, men and women who are not supportive of the establishment and who are assumed to be communist extremists. And this could mean anyone, including human rights activists such as myself. The great pains to which he refers coincided with the fateful 1962 decision. In that year, Kennedy sent a special forces mission to Colombia, led by General William Yarborough. Yarborough advised paramilitary, sabotage, and/or terrorist activities against known communist proponents to be employed now if we have such an apparatus in place. We, because there is no need to prevaricate in secret communications. In counterinsurgency doctrine, the phrase known communist proponents extends to the categories of assumed communist extremists that Vasquez Carrizosa enumerates, a fact well known to Latin Americans, just as they know that the primary victims are the poor and oppressed who are daring to raise their heads. The national security doctrine reached Central America in the 1980s. El Salvador became the leading recipient of U.S. military aid as state terror reached its awful peak. When Congress hampered direct military aid and training by imposing human rights conditions, as in Guatemala after massive government atrocities, surrogates undertook the task. The victims do not easily forget, though among the powerful, these crimes are subject to the standard ritual avoidance of unacceptable facts. Hardly a day passes without examples. Thus, a front-page story in the national press warns that the threat of Al-Qaeda is increasing as it is turning from targets that are well protected to so-called soft targets. The story should at once recall Washington's official instructions to its proxy forces to attack soft targets in Nicaragua immediately after it was ordered by the highest international authorities to terminate its terrorist war, and the reaction to these orders. Whether attacking soft targets is right or wrong, terrorism, or a noble cause, depends on who is the agent. The practice is routine and unproblematic once moral truisms have been deemed irrelevant and unwanted facts efficiently disappeared. The art of disappearing unwanted facts. One contributor to the Yale volume, Charles Hill, observed that 9/11 opened the second war on terror, the first having been declared by the Reagan administration 20 years earlier, a rare recognition of reality. "And we won the first war," Hill reports triumphantly, though the terrorist monster was only wounded, not slain. How we won is someone else's department, the Jesuit intellectuals in Central America, the School of the Americas, truth commissions, serious scholarship, activist and solidarity literature, and the memories of the survivors. We can learn a good deal about the current war on terror by inquiring into the first phase and how it is now portrayed. One leading academic specialist describes the 1980s as the decade of state terrorism, of persistent state involvement or sponsorship of terrorism, especially by Libya and Iran. The U.S. merely responded with a proactive stance toward terrorism. Others recommend the methods by which we won, the operations for which the U.S. was condemned by the World Court and Security Council, absent the veto, are a model for Nicaragua-like support for the Taliban's adversaries. A prominent historian of the subject, David Rappaport, finds deep roots for the terrorism of Osama bin Laden in South Vietnam, where the effectiveness of Viet Cong terror against the American Goliath, armed with modern technology, kindled hopes that the Western heartland was vulnerable too. The villainy of the terrorists attacking us everywhere is awesome indeed. Keeping to convention, these analyses portray the U.S. as a benign victim, defending itself from the terror of others, the Vietnamese in South Vietnam, the Nicaraguans in Nicaragua, Libyans and Iranians, if they ever suffered a slight at U.S. hands, it passes unnoticed, and other anti-American forces worldwide. If not everyone in the world shares that perception of history, then they too are anti-American and can be safely dismissed. As discussed earlier, the plague of U.S.-backed state terror that spread through Latin America in the 1960s peaked in Central America in the 1980s, as Reagan's war on terror took its deadly toll. Central America was one prime focus of that onslaught. The other was the Mideast Mediterranean region. Here, too, the contrast between what actually happened and what is portrayed is dramatic and revealing. In this region, the worst single atrocity during the 1980s was the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, which, like the murderous and destructive Rabin-Peres invasions of 1993 and 1996, had little pretense of self-defense. In the light of crucial Reagan-Clinton support, these operations add to Washington's record of state-supported international terrorism. The U.S. was directly involved in many other acts of terror in the region, including the three candidates for the prize of most extreme terrorist atrocity of 1985, when terrorism in that region was selected by editors as the lead story of the year. 1. The car bomb outside a mosque in Beirut that killed 80 people, mostly women and girls, and wounded 250 others, timed to explode as people were leaving and traced back to the CIA and British intelligence. 2. Shimon Peres's bombing of Tunis, killing 75 people, Palestinians and Tunisians, expedited by the U.S. and praised by Secretary of State Schultz, then unanimously condemned by the U.N. Security Council as an act of armed aggression, with the U.S. abstaining. And 3. Perez's Iron Fist operations, directed against what the Israeli High Command called terrorist villagers in occupied Lebanon, reaching new depths of calculated brutality and arbitrary murder, in the words of a Western diplomat familiar with the area, amply supported by direct coverage, total casualties unknown in accord with the usual conventions. All these atrocities fall within the category of state-supported international terrorism, if not the more severe war crime of aggression. This accounting excludes many other atrocities, such as the regular kidnappings and killings on the high seas by Israeli naval forces attacking ships in transit between Cyprus and northern Lebanon, with many of those captured brought to Israel and kept in prison without charge as hostages, and numerous other crimes that are not crimes because they were backed by Washington. In journalism and scholarship on terrorism, 1985 is recognized to be the peak year of Middle East terrorism, but not because of these events, rather because of two terrorist atrocities in which a single person was murdered, in each case an American. In the worst of the two terrorist atrocities that passed through the doctrinal filters, a crippled American Jew, Leon Klinghoffer, was brutally murdered during the hijacking of the Achille Lauro cruise ship in October 1985 by a Palestinian terrorist group led by Abu Abbas. The murder seemed to set a standard for remorselessness among terrorists, New York Times correspondent John Burns wrote. Burns described Abu Abbas as the has-been monster who may finally have to face a day of reckoning with American justice for his role in the crime. One of the heralded achievements of the invasion of Iraq was the capture of Abu Abbas a few months later. The Klinghoffer murder remains the most vivid and lasting symbol of the ineradicable evil of Arab terrorism and the unanswerable proof that there can be no negotiating with these vermin. The atrocity was very real and is in no way mitigated by the terrorist plea that the hijacking was in retaliation for the far more murderous U.S.-backed Israeli terrorist attack on Tunis a week earlier. But the bombing of Tunis does not enter the canon of terrorism because it is subject to the wrong agent fallacy. It remained unmentioned when Abu Abbas was captured. There would, of course, be no difficulty in apprehending the monsters Shimon Peres and George Shultz, who are far from has-beens, and bringing them to a day of reckoning with American justice. But that is beyond unthinkable. Also efficiently disappeared are recent events that bear more than a superficial similarity to the Klinghoffer murder. The reaction was silence when British reporters found the flattened remains of a wheelchair in the remains of the Jenin refugee camp after Sharon's spring 2002 offensive. It had been utterly crushed, ironed flat as if in a cartoon, they reported. In the middle of the debris lay a broken white flag. A crippled Palestinian, Kamal Zuhair, was shot dead as he tried to wheel himself up the road. The Israeli tanks must have driven over the body, because when a friend found it, one leg and both arms were missing, and the face, he said, had been ripped in two. If even reported in the U.S., this would have been dismissed as an inadvertent error in the course of justified retaliation. Kamal Zuhair does not deserve to enter the annals of terrorism along with Leon Klinghoffer. His murder was not under the command of a monster, but a man of peace, who enjoys a soulful relationship with the man of vision in the White House. The basic dynamic at work was outlined 20 years ago by one of Israel's most eminent writers and commentators, Boaz Evron, after an upsurge of settler IDF violence that caused much consternation in Israel. Evron wrote a sardonic account of how to deal with the lower orders, the Arabushim in Israeli slang. Israel should keep them on a short leash, he wrote, so that they recognize that the whip is held over their head. As long as not too many people are being visibly killed, then Western humanists will accept it all peacefully and even ask, what is so terrible? The guardians of journalistic integrity in the U.S. understand the lesson without Evron's advice. The most prestigious media watchdog, the Columbia Journalism Review, gave its cherished laurel to the U.S. media for their coverage of Sharon's spring 2002 offensive in Jenin, Nablus, Ramallah, and elsewhere, in the 35th year of Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. The recipients earned the laurel, according to the review, for ensuring that scrutiny of the offensive would focus on one cardinal question: was there a purposeful massacre of hundreds of civilians in the Jenin refugee camp? If not, then civilized people can accept it all peacefully. We might try a thought experiment. Suppose that Syria had occupied Israel for 35 years, employing the means and measures of Israel's occupation, and then proceeded further to duplicate Sharon's 2002 offensive. rampaging through Jewish towns, leveling large areas with bulldozers and tanks, keeping the population under siege for weeks without food or water or access to medical care, destroying cultural centers and the institutions of government and archaeological treasures, making it crystal clear to the Yids in every possible way that the whip is held over their head, but not slaughtering hundreds of them at once. According to the standards of the Laurel, only an anti-Arab racist would object, and discovery of the scattered parts of a murdered Jewish cripple in a wheelchair crushed by a Syrian tank would merit no notice, let alone stern American justice. Reviewing the Jenin story, the review berated the British press for embracing Israel's guilt as an established fact, and ridiculed the UN for preparing an investigation by a team whose political sympathies ensured that its conclusions would be challenged, certainly by the independent thinkers of the review. Amid all this confounding din, the editors asked, what was the world to believe? Fortunately, all was not lost. Enter the independent U.S. news media on a fact-finding mission of their own, which refuted the anti-Israel slanders and revealed that there was no deliberate cold-blooded murder of hundreds at Jenin. In fact, reaching exactly the same conclusions as the disreputable British media and others, which, however, did not adopt the framework of U.S.-Israeli propaganda as rigidly as the editors of the review demand, and scrutinized the Israeli invasion beyond that single question. The independent U.S. media did not merit the insulting praise of their cheerleader. Careful readers could learn about the crimes that had taken place, though not in the shocking detail presented in the Israeli and European press. And they were carefully protected from the complicity of their own government, in routine fashion. When the wrong agents are implicated in state-supported international terrorism, we sometimes discover that terrorist atrocities are not fully effaced, but rather praised. An instructive case is the country that replaced El Salvador as the leading recipient of U.S. military aid and training, Turkey, where state terror was practiced on a massive scale through the Clinton years, relying on U.S. support. I borrow the term state terror from the Turkish State Minister for Human Rights, referring to the vast atrocities against Kurds in 1994. And from sociologist Ismail Besici, returned to prison after publishing his book State Terror in the Near East, having already served 15 years for recording Turkish repression of Kurds. As elsewhere, unacceptable facts were disappeared, but the events did not pass entirely unnoticed. The State Department's Year 2000 report on Washington's effort to combat terrorism singled out Turkey for its positive experiences in combating terror, along with Algeria and Spain, worthy colleagues. This praise was reported without comment in a front-page story in the New York Times by its specialist on terrorism. In a leading journal of international affairs, Ambassador Robert Pearson reports that the U.S. could have no better friend and ally than Turkey in its efforts to eliminate terrorism worldwide, thanks to the capabilities of Turkey's armed forces demonstrated in their anti-terror campaign in the Turkish southeast. As noted, the voluntary U.S. censorship of Turkish state terror was eased slightly in early 2003, during Turkey's democratic deviation, though the decisive role of the United States remained well concealed. The considerations just reviewed, a small sample, suggest one simple way to reduce the threat of terror. Stop participating in it. That would be a significant contribution to a general war on terror. Nevertheless, it would not address the category of terror that passes through the doctrinal filters, their terror against us and our clients, an extremely serious matter, no doubt. Let us put that issue aside for a moment and consider a related domain in which attention to truisms may have some value. Truisms and just war theory. The theory of just war has enjoyed a revival in the context of the new era of humanitarian intervention and international terrorism. Consider the strongest case put forth, the bombing of Afghanistan, a paradigm example of just war, according to the Western consensus. The respected moral political philosopher Jean Beth Gielstein summarizes received opinion fairly accurately when she writes that nearly everyone, with the exception of absolute pacifists and those who seem to think that we should let ourselves be slaughtered with impunity because so many people out there hate us, agrees that the bombing of Afghanistan was clearly a just war.